Station number 22353, Reel 10.
Eric Warburton, Reel 10.
He slung this half crown across the table towards me and said, "Here, get yourself a cup of tea before you go home." And then he said, "What's your connection with the police?" And I said, "Because I've been training to be a probation officer." So he said, "Oh, well, yes, you're quite happy about that." And then he said, "Hodges, he's been in the army." And I said, "Well, do you mean Hodges the builder?" So he said, "Yes." "Oh, I know him." And so he said, "Red-headed." And I said, "That's right." And I said, "I was at college with him." And so that satisfied him completely. And he said, "All right, my boy, I'll see you tomorrow morning then." And I said, "Yes, all right." So I settled down with them and began my work with Sharp Brothers and Knight, and starting as a draftsman in a joinery works it was, and I started as a draftsman in their drawing office, and then shortly afterwards I went into the estimating office because they were short-handed. And that became a real dream of a job because I had no problems with it whatsoever. I liked it and I found myself very comfortable. And so I continued for something like 2 or 3 years in there, and people came and went and I remained. And then Frank Evans, who was this man that was in charge of this department, said he was going off to Finland, I think it was, or to see some work, which some windows which Holkins wanted us to produce under license. And in the meantime, I'd been looking at the fact that there was a certain man, a technical rep, who was down in Bedfordshire, who appeared to be leaving. And I went to see, when Frank Evans went off to his trip, I went to see the director in charge of the outside representation, and I said to him, "I would like to have a go at this job." So he said, "Well, I didn't think you wanted to leave Derby, and I didn't think you wanted to leave because your father's really ill." I said, "Yes, he is, but I think I've got to think of my wife and whatever family." So he said, "All right, the job's yours." So I felt quite pleased about this, and awaited the return of my immediate boss to say, to tell him, and to thank him for his, so he was he came back, of course, and he was very niggled that I had done this, and said, "Well, he took me aside eventually and kept me there till about 7 o'clock or gone one night, telling me how I had not got the right capability of doing this job, and that it would be quite useless to allow me to go ahead. But if I wanted the job, I had better make an application like everybody else." And he would give it to him, and he would present it to the governor. This I did straight away, of course. And at that time, the boss's daughter and I used to play badminton and used to play tennis, things like that, at lunchtime. And so She had been brought back from Montague Mayor's from London by the governor to work for him and as his secretary, I said to her, had this letter arrived on the governor's desk? And she said, no. And I said, I think I better do something about it then. So every night I used to take this chap home because he lived just on the outskirts of Burton-on-Trent, and I used to go back to Derby every night. So I said to him, and we used to stop to get his, on a Thursday night, we used to stop to get his coupon for his football pools. And when he came back out there, I said to him, as he got back into the car, oh, do I owe you a Trump St. Louis stamp? And he said, no, why? I said, well, the letter that you were going to forward to the governor. And he put his hand in his inside pocket. Now I said, you will put that on the boss's table in the morning, and I shall know whether you've done it or not, because I've asked people to let me know that it's there. So he did that, and of course I was called up by the boss, and he said, you've applied for this job, and I said, yes, knowing it was John Brothers Knight. And he said, right, very good, then it's, and I agree. But he said, I understand your father's very ill, very gravely ill. And I said, yes, he is. Then he said, I'm going to send you down to look at the house. It's a tied house, but we don't want you there too long. You get your own place built or whatever. And then he said, you can call on one or two people while you're there. We've got some work going through for them, so go and see that everything's all right. Which I did. I went home and met my wife in the, they gave me the keys. I picked my wife up in Derby, as arranged. It's on the Friday night, and she said to me, what are those keys on the dashboard? And I said, they are to a house in Luton, in Bedfordshire. We are moving. That was a shock. She'd never moved away from home virtually since she had any time. And we went down on the Saturday morning to view this place. And it was in an unmade road, and it stood like the Gibbs Dentifrice Castle, as it was. You know, Gibbs used to have this sort of big castle at one time. And it was a pair of houses, and but very large houses, and surrounded by what looked something similar to a council house development, really. But anyway, and of course, we went in, opened the door, went inside, and never saw a house like it. It was purple, it was pink, it was all sorts of colours. And with that, she broke down and had a real sort of cry about this. And the dear lady next door, the neighbours, I remember her putting her head over the board, and she said, my name's Skinner. Why don't you come round for a cup of tea? So we went round to see Mr. and Mrs. Skinner, who were London people, and they, and so there she was, and she gave a cup of tea, and she resolved the problem. And and eventually we did move down into this house, having done the necessary decorations and got it all into real ship-shape order. And so I moved then from the Burton-on-Trent works situation into the privilege of a technical rep for the company, and I had Bedfordshire, Buckinghamshire and Hertfordshire as my territory.
Could I just stop you there to ask you about something else, please? And that is, when you finished in the war, did you find it difficult in any way to readapt to civilian life? Had you become a changed person?
Oh, yes. I changed from being an introvert to an extrovert. I had a very narrow upbringing, and obviously that was the first thing that took place, that I was... In the army, you change over, you've got to change overnight. You've got to catch up with everybody, you've got to be up front with all that's going within the army terms, in the army, nothing outside of it, but within the army complex itself. And that develops into develops the person into something entirely, well, not different, but and more mature, more able to sort things out for oneself and provide a new aspect, as it were, on life in general. The training in first place was enough to change everybody into something different from the way that you walked about, for instance, went into something entirely almost like machine type. You obeyed the commands and you did all sorts of things. I mean, I can't imagine myself at that stage in 1939 saying to somebody as I did, what would you do? Well, I spent X years in the army, how would you feel about this job, you know, to a man that I'd never seen before? But I did, and it came quite naturally. So I think there was a great change between the two. Now, and as I arrived home, of course, that was the thing. One thing was difficult, and that was I considered that the country owed me something insofar that I'd expended these years on their behalf, and I got some relatives who said, you know, whenever I went home on leave, when are you going to get this finished? I don't get any rest at night. I'm always out doing fire picketing or something, or the ARP. And they were at the same time earning fabulous money building aircraft wings and things of that nature. So that was something which I thought, well, now these people owe me something. But they didn't. And they made it quite plain. Nobody owed me anything. And I had a friend who... Well, it was a bandmaster, actually, because I immediately took up with the band again in the Salvation Army. And Jock Tilliver said, because petrol is rationing, I'll pick you up. I'll take you down there. And he was chief cashier for a very large engineering company. So I thought to myself, now, I'll work this out, this man, I'll get it sorted out, he'll come to it, I'll get to a position where I can be able to put him in a situation where he can't refuse to let me have a job within his company. And I said to him, I worked on this line, this tact, until we got down to the service, and then he picked me up afterwards at lunchtime, and he said, do you know, I get the feeling that you believe that I could, or should, get you a job in my company. I thought, oh, bingo, I've struck a chord. And so he said, I think that you should stand on your own feet. You should get a job you know something about, and that you think strongly about it, and also I suggest that you get out here and you walk home and think about it. And that left me with about 2.5 miles to go to get home. And he shot off. I saw the light of it by the time I got home. I decided that nobody was going to help me at all, and therefore I got to do something on my own accord. Nobody was waiting for me to come home and say, oh, you need a job, here's a job. I decided I'd follow up this VD situation. I'd like to very much to have got back into come back into the medical world. I'd have liked to have become proficient and whatnot, you know, to go into running a VD clinic. And for that purpose, I thought it would be a good idea if I saw the medical officer of health. I had a one-time mayor of Derby was my uncle, and so I went to him in his place of work, because he ran a business, and I said exactly that, you know, I'd like to see this, because he was very pleased to see me, and because of some many years ago, when I was in the baby arm, my mother took umbrage at something which he had said, and therefore vowed that I would never cross his door, etc., and all this sort of thing. But anyway, I went, and so he said, "What can I do for you?" And I said, "I'd like to see this chap and you know, this medical officer's help of health." "Right," he said. "So you shall." And in fact, he said he'll come down to see you, because he can come down here. And he arranged this meeting, and so I went and saw this chap, and an elderly gentleman who came, and I told him what experiences I'd had, etc., etc. And he said, "Oh, my boy," he said, "that's all gone by." He said, that's the army. He said, "You won't get that sort of thing now. It's oh no," he said, "you'll find that there's no need to follow that line." He said, "It'll all be cleared up now. Nobody will have this VD." And so he washed that out. How wrong he was. And I didn't like to tell him how wrong he was because of what I'd seen. But there it was. That was another one who didn't feel that they could help at all. And so this went on for about a year, you see. I went to the local hospital and on offer my services at the Derbyshire Royal Infirmary. And I had an interview with the matron. And she felt that it was in in her power to sort of tell me, to say in no uncertain terms, to go and get myself a proper job. She could only offer me, some long hours and only 48 shillings a week or something of that nature, and therefore I should go and book for something which is more suitable. So the end of my medical career, I think, came then. So,
what was this medical officer of health's idea that because antibiotics had come on the scene that VD would be a thing of the past?
I think so, yes. Yes, and he was quite convinced that it wouldn't exist any longer. He must have been blind. No way would it be a situation worth bothering about in future. And you know, it was a wartime experience only, you know, a wartime situation only. How wrong he was.
Could you say something about the Germans you treated, please?
Oh, yes. The the difference between the elder people and as patients at the Wehrmacht and the youngsters in particular, the ordinary soldiers were always in fear of going to the tower, and they would say to you, "Where are we going?" And we say, "Go back to England." And they immediately had the impression that the tower had got elastic sides, because everybody was going to go there, and how we would cope with these thousands of people in the Tower of London, I don't really know. But the youngsters were the worst. They would, as you bent over to treat them, they would spit in your face, and that was a great sadness, really, because we were doing our best for them as we would do for anybody else. And the ordinary soldiers, well, they took it more philosophically, but they were in fact realizing that they were now in captivity, and it seemed to be a par for the course, as it were. The officers that we were, German officers, were a bit better insofar that they looked at things in a slightly different way. They had possessions, and I remember one officer that we had, through, he had acquired a pair of wonderful brown boots, and obviously they had been taken from an officer, a British officer, and he had carried these back with him as far as our establishment was concerned, and as he left, he was again, for some reason or other, somebody had taken the boots off the stretcher and placed them on the floor, and as he was wounded on his backside, he was facing downward, and he waved goodbye to these boots, and I realised that he was waving goodbye to something, spotted these boots, and I said, no, I picked them up, you take them with you, and so he had a wave, and he was quite all right. The Wehrmacht, of course, they were family people, and they would bring out their, try and show you their families and their loved ones, and I think that they were more conscious of the fact that they were on the wrong course, and that this was all part and parcel of their job, which they didn't like. So, hence the things. Our main job, of course, was to treat them and to get them comfortable and to put the bits and pieces together as best as we could in this as the circumstances.
But the tower had a fearsome reputation.
Oh yes, it did. Yes, I think everybody was terrified just about the tower, and I don't really know what vision they got of the tower, but they seemed to think that everybody would be going to the tower, and presumably they were going to have the head chopped off. I don't know.